Someone wanted to know, what are some of the most common misconceptions about Buddhist philosophy or Buddhist view? This is kind of fun to think about. One of my favorite is that Buddhism is all about suffering and says nothing about pleasure. Now, this is actually so far from my own experience, it's hard for me even to say something about this without laughing a little bit. Because in my own experience through mindfulness practice and meditation and removing some of the layers of resistance to life and all of its challenges in my heart, my joy is so much bigger and comes so much easier and stays so much longer. And by wishing joy for others and forwarding that rather than wishing for pleasure and good fortune and joy for myself as my number one goal, I've multiplied my joy so many times, not with intention, but it just arises like that. But it is true in Buddhism, when we talk about pleasure, we say, you know, pleasure, it's unstable, it's impermanent, and it doesn't support your awakening. You know, desire is this kind of knotted ball of trouble. So that's true. That is in the liturgy of Buddhism. But it's also true that all of Tibetan Buddhism in the higher practices, they're all working with high states of bliss. And what you might call a transcendental bliss, you know, bigger than the joy of this world, bigger than any joy of this world. So I don't think that it's really fair game to say that Buddhist practitioners are against pleasure. And I think you could say, gosh, we talk a lot about trading something very small for something very big. How's that? So let's see, another misconception. How about that desire is the root cause of all suffering? There is talk about that in Buddhist dogma, craving as the cause of suffering. But that's a kind of level of speech, and if we go down under that, often what's being talked about is that it's one's confusion about the nature of oneself and about reality in general that is the source of the suffering. The desire, from my perspective, is more a symptom of that. And that confusion then is the confusion that is, if not the root source, but possibly even the root source, really, that delusion or enchantment or confusion is what causes afflictions, desire, all of the kleshas, conflicting emotions. So what about another one? Let's see. What about misconceptions that desire is, as a nun, I'm pretty familiar with this one, desire is non-virtuous. There's writing like that. There are words like that. But remember, when we read the Dharma or listen to the Dharma, we have to both hear the words and also come to rest in the meaning of the words. So desire or attachment is often associated in the literature with non-virtue. That's true. That's true. But also not always. So we could have the desire to awaken, the desire to benefit other people, the desire for peace for ourselves and all beings. Usually when someone is talking about that desire, they're using the word wish or aspiration. It's a little different, right? The desire for non-virtuous things, that would be for power over another person or for a wild amount of wealth and power that one could then misuse to harm others. I think that is a different word in Tibetan, you know. That's not aspiration, that's duchak. Duchak. And that word in Tibetan does have a kind of negative feel about it. How about the misconception that Buddhism sees the ego as the enemy? I remember a friend of mine who was a student of another great Tibetan teacher said, in order to dismantle the ego, you first have to have one. I thought that was pretty good. But the root cause of suffering, and therefore we could say, if we want to use the word enemy, the enemy, is one's own confusion about the nature of reality, the nature of phenomena. And that's the root of suffering, like I said a minute ago. But it isn't really a battle between our goodness and our ego. It's not exactly like that. Even in the story of Buddha's enlightenment, remember when the Maras, these entities that came to Buddha at the time of his awakening, just before he was awakening, what were those Maras? That was not his self-centeredness, you know? It was more his grasping at ignorance and his attachment to worldly concerns and sense desires. Our self-centeredness, our powerful ego, these are just an aspect of mind. They're not a thing, you know. The ego is not a thing in Buddhism. It's not a separate thing, not an enemy in that sense. A little bit this feels like the devil in Christianity, you know. It's a little different than that in Buddhism. What about the misconception? Here's a really common one, that life is a dream. That's not what the Buddha said. He said, consider the dreamlike nature of reality, dreamlike. Didn't say it was a dream. So dreamlike nature of reality, you know, what's it like if you're having a dream and a tiger is chasing you? And as your heart is pounding and you're sweating if you're smart and trying this and that and really feeling that you must about in a moment will be eaten or something, all of that. And then you wake up and then you discover, oh, huh, Whew, that was a dream. There's nothing to be afraid of. I'm fine. Things are fine as they are. That's sort of the vein of the dreamlike quality of life. So along those lines, and really worse than that one, I think, is the misconception that because we use the word emptiness in Buddhism, and emptiness really means this kind of infinite matrix of everything that causes everything to exist, or everything is inside that matrix existing. And if you pull out one thread in the matrix, then everything shifts a little bit. But that's different. The word empty in English means nothing inside. An empty glass is a glass with nothing inside. There is not a tradition of Buddhism who asserts that nothing exists. So they fight a lot, all the traditions, about exactly how things exist. But a complete outright denial of existence would be nihilism. And nihilism is not only a wrong view, a confused view, but it's a dangerous view. And it is actually sometimes a kind of innocent or naive byproduct of practice that a person, especially a person without a teacher, can get themselves into a jam. And so they read various Buddhist teachings without proper interpretation, and they come to the conclusion that nothing exists, and therefore, why should I bother? If you're in that kind of jam, you must talk to a teacher right away, because it is confusion. It is not a representation of a true view in Buddhism. You know, if that was a view in Buddhism, it could not be a tradition of awakening, could it? It could not be a tradition that, as the Buddha said, would resolve our suffering and the causes of suffering. It would be just the opposite. All right, let's see. What's another misconception? One common misconception is that all the things that Buddhists believe were taught by the Buddha himself. So, first of all, there were beliefs that appear in Buddhism, I think this is true in many religions, that appear in Buddhism that were there before Buddhism was a religion. So, for example, the idea of karma, the idea of rebirth, those were in place a long time before the Buddha was born. And he taught about those things, and maybe he had his own spin, you know, on the meaning of those things. It's often the case when a religion develops in a culture that it takes on some of the perspectives and beliefs of the traditions that preceded it, of indigenous traditions or otherwise. And this is true in Buddhism also. But there are some teachings that the Buddha taught which were not a part of earlier Indian traditions of his time. And those would include things like monasticism and the concept of nirvana, enlightenment, and the concept of bodhicitta, awakening heart, the Four Noble Truths, the doctrine of emptiness, dependent origination, the doctrine of no self, the doctrine of the two truths, relative and ultimate. Yeah, so the Buddha had a lot of things that were original ideas, but not everything that's in Buddhism. the concept of samsara, in fact, was a part of Indian tradition and rebirth also, long before the Buddha came about. Let's see, can I think of anything else? Oh, here's one. So when I did 3-year retreat, people would always say to me, how can you, who wish to be kind and useful in the world, how can you want to do something in a tradition that's about withdrawing from the world? This is a misconception that completely misses the boat of Buddhism. Buddhism is about First of all, let's say this. One of the key principles of Buddhism is interconnectedness, right? I couldn't be concerned about myself rightly without being concerned about everything. And so how could you found a religion that is about withdrawing from the world, which had a key principle, which is interconnectedness of all things in that world? In fact, almost as if the world itself is just completely this alive ball of interconnectedness. So Buddhism has a lot about learning how to engage with the world. This skillful means is called, you know? Learning how to engage with friends and family and animals and the land and the elements. And it is true that I and others do choose in their study of Buddhism and in particularly in their practice of Buddhism to withdraw their presence of the world for some period of time, days, weeks, months, or years. And this really is a matter, well, let me speak for myself on this one. You know, I'm a rookie, and so 25 years into practice, I thought I need the support of a quiet place, a peaceful place. A place of less distraction, a place that supported what I was trying to do with a contemplative mind and practice. But just as it did for me in my 3-year retreat when I came out, I thought, okay, now I'll retire and finally learn to make a pie crust and paint and do some other things. And then some people showed up. And they asked for teachings. They asked to be together and to practice together. So the Buddha, you know, was enlightened. And I think that I read that he also thought, I don't think I'll teach this. Maybe no one will understand. Maybe he even had a thought like, wow, I might be viewed as a crank of some kind. Okay, I don't think he thought that, but I think he did think that who would understand this experience if they hadn't had it. Nonetheless, people asked for teachings, and he came out of solitude and began to interact. And almost all contemporary practitioners need the engagement with the ordinary world, with everyday life. Certainly I do, to cultivate, to practice, to learn from the people and the situations and the environments around me. And then here's a fun one. One misconception is that all Tibetan Buddhists are vegetarians. You know, they're not. In fact, I think it might be closer to the truth that the majority of monastics in the world eat meat. And that has to do with vows that monastics take to consume what is offered. And in the Tibetan tradition, many of the monks and nuns came from places, particularly the older ones, very high altitude, very harsh environment. And so perhaps a vegetarian diet just didn't quite have enough fat. But even for those people, there are many mentions of this in Buddhist literature, that one is admonished to choose carefully, to decide for oneself what one's actions contribute to the life or the death of other beings. I can remember talking to my teacher about this, and he said, whatever you choose, you should at least be grateful. At least be grateful. Isn't that beautiful? And then there's this last one, which is maybe worth repeating. And I think I held this misconception myself for a while, so I might as well confess it to you here. I used to kind of feel that there was what I used to call Buddhism light, and then there was the real thing. And I had a kind of uppity relationship to that, which I'm not proud of. It came from a good place in a way. I wanted in this one brief life to do everything possible to honor the cultural roots of the teachings of Buddhism as they were transmitted to me, to honor my Tibetan teachers. And I felt great risk because of my own lack of understanding and experience of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I didn't want to do that. And I saw a lot of the teachings in contemporary centers and in books and online and so forth, or just kind of Buddhism light, you know, be a better person, be kind. But then on our three-year retreat, Rinku Tulku, Tibetan teacher, was visiting, and he made the comment, never underestimate the power or importance or goodness of good citizen Buddhism. And I thought about that for a very long time. And I thought, really, on some infinite scale, my own practice is really very childlike, very simple. I'm trying to love more, to harm less. And so where on that spectrum does it become Buddhism light? And I thought, what an arrogant position I have taken. And the more I contemplated that over time, the more I came to feel that actually I trust the Dharma. I trust the Dharma. I had misplaced my trust in persons, in the teachers of certain kinds of methods, and in the students who practice in certain ways. And that's not a correct placement of trust. And so I picked up that trust and ran the experiment of, what if I trust the power of the Dharma? What if I trust the power of wisdom itself? And as if years have gone by, I've come to believe any practice, any awakening, anything that genuinely leads us in the direction of more wisdom, more compassion, more direct relationship with truth is good. And if what one is able to accomplish in one's lifetime is consistent kindness, this is really, in and of itself, a treasure. To not be disrespected by someone as small and simple as myself. So thank you for the question, what are some of the common misconceptions in Buddhism? That was fun to think about. And perhaps if you think of some more, we can talk about that in one of our Monday night sessions.